Open the House Committee on Human Services on today, April 20th, and open up the work session on House Bill 3102.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3102 in its original form transferred all the duties, functions, and powers over court-appointed special advocates and CASA volunteer programs from the State Commission on Children and Families to the Judicial Department. On or before July 1, 2011, it required the Commission to provide all records and property related to CASAs and CASA volunteer programs, unexpended balances derived from dedicated revenues, expenditure classifications, and acts authorizing or limiting expenditures to the Judicial Department and declared an emergency effective on passage. We do have two amendments before you for consideration, the Dash 5 amendments and the Dash 6 amendments. The Dash 5 amendments we talked about last meeting on Monday. The Dash, in essence, that the program would go to the judicial branch initially. The Dash 6 amendments are new. They replace the Dash 4 amendments, which we talked about on Monday. They just tweak them a little bit. In essence, it's an intermediate step to where the funding would go to DAS for a year and a task force would be established in order to ultimately move the program. So, as Representative Kotek explained on Monday, it's a kind of a twofold process. So those are the two amendments for consideration.
And Representative Thompson, the original bill was your bill. Do you want to speak on this?
Well, I think that we've made a lot of progress. I'm favoring the Dash 6 amendments because they buy us time. There are a couple of questions yet revolving around responsibilities, but I think we can handle those in ways and means with budget notes, if nothing else. So
great.
Make sure that all the players in the intermediate step know where they stand. And it's not the best outcome. It's the best outcome we can get in the time frame we have to work in.
Thank you very much, Representative. So we need to adopt the Dash 6, right?
First, Madam Chair, one thing I should note, this does have a referral to Ways and Means. We have not received fiscal impact or revenue impact statements on either the Dash 5 or 6 amendments. So given this is the last day to move bills, we do need a two-thirds majority to suspend the rules in order to move these out without impact statements. So Representative Gilliam and Representative Tomei have that information, but that would be the process we would need to do.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, given that explanation and our consultation with our counterparts on Ways and Means and the last day to move bills and so forth, I therefore move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on this bill, House Bill 3102, without having the fiscal impact statement on hand at this time.
Representative Co-Chair Gilliam moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 3102 without having the fiscal impact statement on hand at this time. Those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on 3102 without having the fiscal impact statement on hand at this time will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries and the rules have been suspended. Thank you.
Madam Chair, are you entertaining another motion?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'd like to move that we adopt the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3102, dated 4-15-11.
Chair Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 6 amendments, dated 4-15-11. Any discussion? Any objection? The amendments are adopted.
And Madam Chair, I'd like also now to move House Bill 3102 as just amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill 3102 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Harper.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative White.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, this bill passes. Thank you, committee. Thank you, Representative Thompson. Okay, we will now open up the work session on House Bill 2049.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2049 in its original form required the Department of Human Services to reimburse an employer for employee expenses for up to 3 months if the employer hires an individual placed with the employer through the Jobs Plus program. It authorized DHS to recover reimbursement paid if the employer fails to retain the employee for 6 months. It authorized the Department of Human Services to restrict access by needy caretaker relatives receiving temporary assistance for needy families to services provided in job opportunity and basic skills programs. It allowed DHS to reduce the aid for 3 consecutive months if the participant in the job opportunity and basic skill program refused to comply with program requirements. It required DHS to terminate the aid if the participant refused to comply with program requirements for 3 months. It expands the requirement of assigning rights of support to state to apply to two-parent family receiving aid that is state-funded or not funded by federal TANF grant. It shortens the time limit for receipt of aid from 60 months to 48 months. It requires DHS to deny aid to a dependent child if the needy caretaker relative living with the child has received aid for 48 months. It limits the type of exceptions that exclude receipt of assistance from counting toward the 48-month limit, and it allows families to receive more than 48 months of aid for months in which specified conditions exist. It extends from July 1, 2011 to July 1, 2013, certain temporary provisions allowing department to suspend statutory requirements for aid. We do have a newly received Dash 1 amendment on House Bill 2049, and Representative Potek is going to address that new amendment.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you. Good morning. good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, back with you to talk about House Bill 2049. And
Co-Chair Tomei and Gilliam, my name is Sochi Esparza. I'm the TANF Program Manager with the Department of Human Services.
So the agency and I, we're going to tag team today on this bill. So the Dash 1 amendment is a complete replacement of House Bill 2049. We did get it at the end of the day yesterday. We also have Lori Freeman from Legislative Council here this morning, who worked tirelessly to get this done in time so we at least have a preview here in the policy committee. I realize since you're getting the amendment today, it's unlikely that you'll want to amend it and move it to Ways and Means, but I hope you'll move the bill as originally introduced to Ways and Means, and then we can continue to have the amendment conversation in the Ways and Means Committee. And I know, you know, in better times and in more clear times, we would have had an earlier conversation about this. But this is an unusual session in terms of trying to understand what our budget has to look like and trying to figure out the statutory changes at the same time. So what you should have a sheet from me that looks like this. It's an explanation of the Dash 1s.
Do we have that?
It's coming. This is my attempt late last night to make this explainable. So we're going to walk through this.
We're going to walk through it even though we're not going to use it?
Well, I think it's important for this committee, to be very honest, to start having more understanding among other members except the Ways and Means about the changes we're going to have to make in the TANF program. I know advocates are anxious to see what we're going to do with this bill, so this is kind of a first take on where we think we're going. Now, certainly a lot of things could change. We still have to figure out what the end game discussion will be about what resources are available and how much of the TANF program we have to cut or not cut. But at least in this bill, you see some of the choices that the co-chairs of the subcommittee have come to some agreement on at this point in time. But again, a lot will be changing. So in the explanation sheet that you have in front of you, I want to just point out the objectives of the Dash 1. Very basically, to provide statutory changes to reduce the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program and the Jobs program budget for the 2011-13 biennium. In doing so, on the second bullet, we will temporarily, in this bill, with the amendment, suspend key parts of the TANF design from 2007, and there's an explanation below, and I'll get to that. So the assumption among the co-chairs was there were some very good programmatic design changes made in 2007 that were working until the caseload ballooned such that it was very difficult to maintain some of that. And so the goal was to suspend portions of that rather than eliminate them completely for the next biennium. The third bullet talks about one change that we're going to make that would be permanent would be modifying the disqualification and reengagement policy from ORS 412.009, which is in Section 2 of the bill. When we redesigned the program in 2007, we were attempting to correct for some excessiveness in how disqualifications were being done by the department. And in doing so, we put in place a disqualification and reengagement policy that inadvertently created some difficulties for case managers in terms of trying to make the disqualification policy work and actually keep families engaged in a way that made sense. And so with feedback, and if you have more questions about that, I'm sure Zoshi would be happy to answer them, but we decided that to course correct from 2007, you would see permanent changes in the modification of the disqualification reengagement policy in Section 2. And then the last bullet, there's some cleanup language regarding child support language for two-parent families, and that's in Section 6. There's no budget impact. That was in the original bill. The department said they needed that fix-it language. So those are the main points in the Dash 1. Like I said, the Dash 1 is a complete replacement of the original bill. With regard to implementing the 18-month time limit, in the original bill, there was a placeholder there for 48 months. There's been a lot of discussion about setting an 18-month time limit. We currently have a 60-month time limit, which matches the federal time limit. You see in the Dash 1, there is no reference to reducing the time limit to 18 months. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. But the co-chairs are still trying to figure out how we can find an offset for that. It could very well happen in ways and means where we need to amend the bill to do that, but this amendment does not have that in there because at this point the co-chairs are committed to trying to figure out how to deal with that. So that's why you don't see any adjustment to the time limit in the amendment. So if I could, I'll move on to the parts that are temporarily suspended. This bill is written kind of interestingly in that the way LC had it drafted is you see one section that makes the change, and then you see the same section later on, which changes it back, and then at the very end you see the implementing language that tells you which sections are start on which dates. So, for example, on the first item there, it says modifying the TANF upfront eligibility process. That's in Section 1, and then it shows up again in Section 8, essentially repealed in Section 8, by the time set in Section 13. So that's the kind of how you see this entire amendment working. For those things that we're temporarily suspending, they get put out, they go put back in, and then there's a date saying when they're going to go into effect. The modification of the TANF upfront eligibility process is a way to it's a budget reduction. It's a way to say how do the most job-ready families who come applying for TANF, they will be required to be participating in the jobs program right at the beginning of application eligibility. And if they're not participating during the eligibility process, there would be consequences for that. I can't remember the exact number. I don't know if you wanted to speak to that at all about why we're doing it. But I'm going to go through the whole list and if you have questions. But that's a budget reduction. The current program is set up such that we try to meet families where they are and not immediately put them into jobs because some of them might need upfront assessment. But given the budgetary restrictions we have, this would modify the upfront eligibility where families would be immediately required to go into jobs participation while they're applying. And that's not the current policy. Number two, we would eliminate the pre-SSI enhanced rate. Currently, there's an enhanced rate for folks who are in the pre-SSI SSDI program, which means they are applying for federal disability. They had received an enhanced rate. This would reduce that for the biennium. Again, shows up in Section 3, repealed in Section 9 by Section 13. Number three, we would eliminate the post-TANF payments. Right now, we are currently providing a $50 post-TANF payment. Once you start to work and you make too much money to be on the program, we provide a $50 payment as kind of to reduce the cliff. We won't be able to afford that probably, and so this would eliminate the post-TANF payment for the biennium. That shows up in Section 11. It's not clear. It's just a reference to a statute, so I just wanted to make sure you understood that. Number four, parents of scholars. That's an option we have in our TANF program for 1% of the caseload that they could pursue a 2 or 4 year degree as a job activity. It's currently fully utilized. We're still trying to decide what to do there, but there was at least an initial consensus that we should grandfather in the individuals who are currently participating in that program as long as they continue to meet their goals, because since it makes more sense to have them finish their educational course than to pull that out from under them right now. So there will be a little bit of budget savings. There would be more budget savings if we eliminated the program entirely, but there was discomfort doing that. So this would suspend the program for new entries for the biennium, but grandfather in the people who are currently in the Parents of Scholars track. Number five, jobs program reduction. This one's a little less clear in the bill. There's just a reference to a section in Section 12. This would significantly allow the department to significantly reduce the supports that come along with the jobs program for employment supports. And then number six is about mandatory participation in the jobs program. Currently, the federal government says you have a 12-month window over the course of your lifetime in TANF, whereby if you've had a new child, you have 12 months by which you wouldn't have to be required to be participating in employment activities. In Oregon, the current statute is you have 6 months, and then you need to get into the jobs program if you have a new child. What we have looked at in looking at other states is because of the difficulty in the supports in jobs that we're going to be able to fund and the fact that the employment situation out there is so difficult, we are proposing making participation in the jobs program voluntary for any parent who has a child under the age of two. Why we would do that is there are some families, and we've heard from some parents who are saying, I have a very young child, I can do some of my job search from home, I don't need to be going, you know, to classes, you know, every day or 30 hours a week. The upshot for the state is we save costs on child care subsidies. If we're not requiring someone at 6 months, once their child is six months old, to go to a jobs program and pay for their child care, if we're not requiring that for everyone, there will be some savings in child care subsidies that we can then redirect to the jobs program for other individuals who are participating. So it would be voluntary. We're making an estimate of what those cost savings would be and how we could redirect them. And did I get that all right?
Yes.
Okay. Questions?
Representative Greenberg.
Yeah, I have a problem with this whole process. I mean, what we're talking about here is some fairly significant changes in a program, and we've had a couple of months to be working these bills, and this is going to turn out with a policy debate in the Ways and Means Committee, where there is not the place to have policy debates. We obviously are going to need to have some changes in this program, but it would seem to me this would have been the place to understand this, and by handing this to us today, this complex amendment. This means we are not going to have a policy debate on this in this committee. And while I sit in the other committee, I suspect we also won't have a policy debate in the other committee because we'll be handed a budget with the instructions, pass this bill because we need it for the budget, and that will be the end of the discussion about changes in TANF. Now, you are the champion of TANF in this building. There's no question about that, and I'm not. But I think this is not a good way to handle what's going to be a very difficult decision. Here I am, and I'll vote for it because I know you need a bill or you'll find another one anyway. But I wish we would have had some real time to discuss it in this committee, which is the place to be talking about.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Greenlick, I really appreciate your comments. You're right. And I want to make sure that it's clear for the record, the department had been asking for many weeks to get amendments to this committee. There was reluctance, I think, to know what exactly those amendments should look like. And again, I think these are still a work in progress. And so I completely understand your desire to have the discussion in this committee. It was not an attempt to cut you out of the process. I think it was very unclear what those amendments should look like until we really grasped the nature of the reductions we were going to have to take. So it is definitely imperfect, but I just want to be clear, it's the agency was not driving this. It was my reluctance to put forth an amendment until we knew exactly where we were headed.
Madam Chair, may I follow?
Representative Greenlick.
What I'd ask is when it comes time to do this, if this committee is still working, to bring it back here for discussion and advice to the Ways and Means Committee. It would seem to me that would be a useful process for us to have feedback into the Ways and Means.
And Madam Co-Chair, if I may, Representative Greenlee, I think that's an excellent suggestion. I know that this bill can't stay here past today, but I don't think that precludes you from having informational hearings on this now that the amendments are out there. I'm sure the advocates will not totally agree with these anyway and will want to have feedback on them, and I would really welcome that opportunity to hear the discussion here with the idea that that would inform, because we frankly don't have the time to do that that fully in the subcommittee. So that would be great.
Thank you.
And absolutely, I totally agree with all of your statements and in your requests. This is the policy committee. We should be making policy here. We haven't had a chance to do that. We haven't had enough time to do informational hearings, to get into the weeds in TANF, in all kinds of programs that we should be having more information about. So hopefully for the rest of this session, we will be taking time for informational hearings now that we've passed the bills that will be coming from our side of the building. We'll be having a few Senate bills coming over, and we'll be hearing those and hopefully passing those. But we'll take time for informational hearings so we can understand more about these agencies that we should be developing policy on. So thank you, Representative Greenlee and Representative Kotek. And I know the time constraints that you're under, not just the time, but the financial constraints. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to kind of echo where Representative Greenlee was, and my question's more to the department. Knowing that we're going into budget constraints, why is this coming out so late? I mean, you should be looking for these changes and efficiencies no matter what the budget is and the best way to provide in these services. I mean, what we just went through, everything sounds good and exactly what we need to do, but we've had no time to look at it, and it's thrown at us here at the last minute. So I'm just wondering who's driving the ship in the department and who's making these decisions. This stuff needs to be here when we walk into this building day one. We should have some sort of plan in January. The day we get sworn in, it would be nice to have something to know what's going on with it and where the failures are, and that way we can start working on policy immediately. And I haven't seen anything like that with TANF, so I would encourage you and your department to probably lean that direction to get us information a little sooner. So if you want to respond to it, you're more than welcome to, but I just wanted to get my thoughts on the record.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, yes, your point is well taken, and we'll take this back. And I think, as Representative Kotek mentioned, the process that she has been going through and the department as well, with a very difficult budget, very tough choices for the governor, this hasn't been easy.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Widener, if I may respond. Again, I really do appreciate that line of questioning. I would also point out, though, when the governor's budget came up, most of the items that you see here were on their reduction list. It did not clarify where they showed up in statute, but you will see the modified TANF upfront eligibility. You'll see the eliminated pre-SSI. You'll see the eliminated post-TANF. Parents of Scholars was eliminated completely in the recommendation. This suspends it and grandfathers in. There was a jobs program reduction that was substantial. The only thing I think that is new here is the very last item in terms of something that the department hadn't proposed. That came through a set of discussions with advocates and what other states were doing, trying to figure out how do we maximize the resources, and this was an option that was put out there about making some of it voluntary for certain ages. So you're absolutely right. The overall budget numbers have been out there. The actual statutory changes have not. So,
if I may follow up. Yeah, my biggest thing is we need to be ahead of the budget and start looking for the most efficient and prudent way to deliver our services right up front, and we're ready to go, and which I guess it doesn't give us any wiggle room when the budget gets cut at that point, but it's kind of nice to say, hey, there's nothing here to cut, because we are doing it right and we are taking care of people. So anyway,
Madam Co-Chair,
things sound great with what you're proposing. I wish we did have time to work on it.
And Madam Co-Chair and Representative Widener, I really do hope you'll have some time for informationals. I don't know how many Senate bills you're going to have. I know you had some informationals early on in the session about TANF. I want to really point out that when we redesigned the program in 2007, given the caseload and given the resources, The program redesign was working. We saw new job placements. We saw our work participation rate increase, which was the point of the redesign to meet new federal reauthorization requirements. The reason we're having to look at these is just basically it's a block grant, the dollars are capped, and the caseload is off the charts. So
grant from the federal government.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate the comments that we need more discussion, but I also want to make sure we know the program was working. The challenge is with the dollars and the caseload, we can't keep the design for the next biennium the way it sits.
And I point out, too, that staff does not make policy. We make policy. The legislature makes policy. Legislature makes the budget. So to expect the staff, I think, to come up with something that's a moving target just isn't going to work. So I think we have equal responsibility working with staff, working with the Ways and Means Committee, and coming up with the kind of answers that I think we're all seeking right now. So, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I guess my concern is that in the whole time we've been here, the only thing I ever heard about TANF from the agency is that, you know, we're thinking about moving it from 60 months or whatever it is down to 18. And that this is coming on the last day and that the agency didn't even come out. I don't know if they didn't come to meet with other members on this policy, but they didn't come to me. So I guess I feel a little bit defensive over voting for something that nobody actually from the agency ever made an effort to come and talk to me as one. I can, like I said, I'm not going to speak for anybody else if they made those appointments elsewhere and I just was out of the loop. And I'm also just not comfortable sending something down to Ways and Means that's a policy decision and yielding those choices there when it never happens in the reverse either. So,
sure.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
I know this isn't your bailiwick because you're on the subcommittee, but I certainly hope when we're looking at this budget this time, because it is so tight, Ways and Means is taking a serious global look at the budget. You know, I'm going to be very, very unhappy if I find out we cut TANF on one end of the budget and approve a project to count pond frogs on the other end of the budget. Mm-hmm. And we have a tendency to do that, and come whenever we get this finished, you know there's going to be a ton of negative press for all the dumb things we did fund when we didn't fund things like this. And I'm hoping Ways and Means in general can get a better handle on that this time and look at all the budgets, because there's a lot of things we probably don't need to be doing this biennium, and this probably isn't one that we don't need to be doing, but being what it is, we'll have to move forward. But, you know, it's... We have done some really dumb things in the past when it comes to project funding, and they're still with us.
And Chair, I want to speak to counting frogs, though.
Okay.
There's always somebody that's a proponent. I can't argue that, but it's up to us to decide what the priority is.
Thank you very much, Representative Thompson. Any other questions or statements?
Representative Greenwood is going to speak to counting frogs.
It's so obvious, I don't even have to speak.
Somebody needs to defend it. Yeah, I know.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much, and thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues.
So I think what our intent is to move the spend rules, right?
No.
No, we don't need to suspend.
Because we're not doing anything.
Okay. So we're just going to move the original bill, correct, to Ways and Means.
Correct.
And there, the changes will be made in Ways and Means.
And I gave you the script for that.
Is that it?
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Widener.
Is there any reason, I mean, obviously we haven't had a chance to go through the amendments, but would it be better for Ways and Means if we adopted the amendments and sent it with the amendments there? No. Actually,
do you want to answer that, Representative Kotick?
I'll be voting blindly, but maybe I don't want to do that.
Madam Chair, Tina Kotick, State Representative. It's really up to you. I am completely sympathetic by the fact that you are adjusting these amendments. There's been discussion around TANF in the billing. We are going to have to make budget cuts. These are the most... This, in my mind, is the most modest package of statutory changes we can make. We might have to make more, particularly around the time limit, and we can do that in ways and means. I want you to be comfortable. I would love to have the vehicle in the committee. You have the amendments. I'd love to see informational hearings. We could go through all of the budget choices and why we ended up with these, and I'd love to get the feedback. We will take that wholeheartedly in the subcommittee. We don't have time to probably have as much discussion as you could have. You have a member of the subcommittee here, so I think it's fine if you pass them without the changes, particularly since you got them today, but I really do appreciate the question.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm only the co-chair of the committee, so this is probably not that important. But I'd like to say that I agreed to listen to the presentation on these amendments, not out of just courtesy, but because of a great respect for you, Representative Kotek, and I'm glad that I did. I know that it's annoying to all of us. I'm not pointing a finger at anybody, particularly you, that we are at the end of first chamber bills, and we're under the gun for the budget. Everybody knows that. Everybody's expressed that. However, it was important, I think, to listen to these amendments. With consultation with your co-chair, mainly through you and your comments, I have no intention of moving these amendments, but I have every intention of moving the bill down there, and I have a great deal of confidence in your ability to work with that subcommittee to do the best we can under these pressurized circumstances. So my intention today will be, when you're ready, to move this bill without an amendment.
Any other? I'm hearing, seeing heads nod. We're okay with that? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Kotek. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2049 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill 2049 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Weiner.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Presser.
Aye.
Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2049 passes and goes to Ways and Means. Thank you very much, Representative.
I look forward to coming back.
Please do. Please do. We have another bill. We have two others. We're waiting on to hear from fiscal regarding 2235. We may have to wait until 9:30. And we do have House Bill 3588. We were waiting for Representative Ben Cannon. Do we know? Can you call his office, please? So we'll just stand at ease for a few minutes.
Okay, we're going to open the House Committee, reopen the House Committee on Human Services, and we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3588.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3588 prohibits the sale of specific flavored smokeless tobacco products that resemble or are marketed as candy. The violation is a Class A violation and punishable by imposing a fine of at least $100 and not more than $720.
Representative Cannon, thank you for your first time, at least in the committee this session.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Ben Cannon, House District 46 in Portland. I don't know if in this committee your co-chair asks witnesses to identify who their favorite co-chair is, but that's his custom in our committee.
Really?
Representative Tomei, you're my favorite co-chair.
Thank you.
Wanted to make sure that was on the record.
I'm really glad it is.
So this bill, turning to a serious subject, House Bill 3588, as you've heard, would make it a Class A violation to sell certain tobacco products in the state of Oregon. And it is a preemptive step to head off an emerging threat to public health. So why this bill, and what are we talking about? That slide up there shows one of the products that would be prohibited under the bill. Orbs, a Camel product, a tobacco-containing product that was test-marketed in Portland within the last couple of years, and you can see very clearly the resemblance to the common breath mint that we know so well. Virtually indistinguishable in packaging and appearance. I can't tell you whether it's indistinguishable in taste. I doubt that it is, but it is flavored, and my understanding is sweetened, and perhaps we'll hear more about that. The product is sold in flavors like fresh, which is minty and mellow, and is very clearly, I think, attempting to take off where breath mints begin. This Orbs experiment in 2009 resulted in at least one accidental ingestion by a toddler. I have an article which I've sent to the committee from Pediatrics that describes some of the concerns that American Academy of Pediatrics has with the product related to its possible ingestion by children. As a parent of a three-year-old, that fact certainly gives me some pause, but I actually think the personal experience that's more relevant to this bill, thank you, Representative, for me is the fact that I've been a middle school teacher for 8 years. And I cannot think of a more effective way to make tobacco appealing to a 12-year-old than to package it in a product that looks very much like mints and fits neatly in a pocket and tastes good. I recall a couple of years ago at my school the breath mint craze and the packaging that got more and more elaborate and the increasingly subtle and cool ways that our students use to hide their breath mints as if they were illicit drugs, which they were not. These were just breath mints. But the fact that this product could be sold, not legally, of course, to 12-year-olds, but could easily find its way into the hands of 12-year-olds, taking off on that, I think, cool factor is and should be of real concern. So this bill, as a general matter, I don't think that the government should play a very active role in determining what should or should not be sold in our stores. But this is clearly a dangerous product. We have a history of well-accepted regulation of tobacco products, particularly as it relates to children. This product itself poses a particular risk to children, and I appreciate the committee's willingness and courtesy in holding this hearing today to begin the discussion. I hope it's one that we're able to continue. I hope also that anyone who is opposed to this bill will have the courage to explain to this committee why the state should not take this preemptive step to keep these products off the shelves of our markets. Representative Widener, I think these came from you, and thank you. This is This is the orbs, and I'll pass these around with your permission.
Actually, and you should strips. Open one and try one.
You'd like me to try one? I'll refrain, but I will pass them around. I will note, and Representative Weiner might if I didn't, they are designed, at least these products are designed to be difficult to open, and even says that here, in order to make less likely this accidental ingestion problem. A couple other products. So these to my understanding is these are not, at least the orbs, are not available in Oregon currently. The company that produces them is no longer test marketing them here. They've moved on to other cities. These are a few products that are easier to open, are available in Oregon. Not sure whether these would be prohibited by our bill, but I think it's worth knowing that these are commonly available, and take a look for yourselves and decide what you think. So I will hand them to the committee assistant. Right, sorry. I'll point that out before we pass that. So just for comparison's sake, there are two that are actually tobacco products, and one is, I was confused, but one that is Trident mints or gum, and you'll see the resemblance. So with that, I will be happy to take questions. We have several other folks here to testify on the bill.
Any questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Cannon? Thank you very much for bringing this bill to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we have several people who signed up to speak. Mel Cohn, Rhett Hamilton, and Stephanie Tamas-Sweet. Welcome, Mel. I think I had seen you in the hall recently and said that you hadn't come at all to our committee this year, right? So it's nice to see you.
Co-chair Tomei, co-chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the director of the Public Health Division and the state public health officer. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to testify about this today. I do have written testimony, which is being distributed now. I'm not going to go through every word of that. I know you have a very busy agenda, but just to summarize, I'm here to support this bill. As a public health practitioner and as a pediatrician and as a father, I am concerned about the appeal that these products have to kids. They're flavored. As Representative Cannon indicated, the issue about overdose is quite real. We understand from our Poison Control Center that they get a fair number of calls about ingestion of products like this. And with kids, it just takes a small amount of nicotine, really, to sicken them. So that's the first concern I have. The second is that I think this is kind of a gateway to further tobacco use down the road. This is a nicotine product, it really is designed to get kids hooked on this, used to the idea that tobacco, nicotine, and so forth is okay, and presumably move them on to cigarettes or other tobacco products further down the road. And, the tobacco industry has spent a lot of money advertising these products, and I think that's why they do it. It's good. It's a good business decision from their standpoint further down the road in terms of marketing their products. And then I guess the last concern I have about this is we have done a lot of work here in Oregon with your support about making it, giving people incentives to quit smoking. And with these products, they're often marketed as a way for people, rather than quitting in a place, for example, where they can't smoke, they can use one of these products and, that'll sort of tide them over. And, I'm very interested in motivating people to quit smoking in the first place. So I think that having these products for sale here is counter to that idea as well. So those are really the three core issues that I'm concerned about and why I support the bill.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cohn. Any questions of Dr. Cohn? Okay, thank you. in both states.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Brett Hamilton. For the record, I'm the Executive Director for the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon. I'm not going to read my testimony, which I have now submitted, but I do want to hit upon some points and kind of tell a story about the realness of these products and how tobacco companies graduate you from a flavored candy-like product to becoming addicted to nicotine and then cigarettes. So I'm from Minnesota, and if you're from Minnesota, you might know we spend a lot of time outside, and we spend a lot of time when you're out fishing and hunting, you don't usually smoke a cigarette. Obviously, it scares away the animal. So we chew a lot. At age 15, I was introduced to chewing tobacco, Skoal Mint, which is actually pretty nice tasting. The first time I tried it, though, just to speak to Dr. Cohn's point, I was so floored by the nicotine that I fell dizzy and threw up. Now, what would make me want to try this again, I'm not sure, but I continued to chew tobacco through high school and into college. With a point then in college, the school rep would come around and pass out packets of the tobacco, little packets, and if you knew the rep well enough, he would give you a whole box full, which my house had a whole box full. That extended my my addiction to chewing tobacco, which then, when I started going to bars at 21, chewing tobacco was not such an attractive thing to do, so I started smoking. Now, I know all there is to know about the dangers of tobacco, and still I continued to smoke until I met my wife, who would not tolerate any tobacco use. So I'm very fortunate. If you know my wife, she doesn't put up with much. So I was very fortunate to break the addiction. My point being that tobacco is one of those things that you start off and it kind of seems like, you know, this is no big deal. I'm just going to try this. The other guys are trying it. But it leads quickly to an addiction that you don't always have control over. So my message today in support of this bill, anything we can do to prevent, to lure to children, to start the addiction is, I think, a move in the right direction. We know the cost of tobacco. We know that smokeless tobacco causes oral cancer. We know it creates an addiction to nicotine, and we know it's a graduation product. I don't think we need much more than that, so I ask you for your support and prohibiting the sale of flavored tobacco and tobacco products that resemble candy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations with the American Heart Association, and we support this bill, House Bill 3588. The health impacts of tobacco, smoking, secondhand smoke are widely documented. I'm sure you are well aware that tobacco is a very addictive product. Tobacco remains still the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon, and also long-term disability as well through some of the debilitating diseases that are associated with tobacco use. Every year, tobacco kills about 7,000 Oregonians, and using current smoking rates, 74,000 kids now under 18 and alive in Oregon will ultimately die prematurely from smoking. Some of the, as you see from my testimony, many diseases associated with tobacco use, including coronary heart disease, which is the leading cause of preventable death in the United States, and congestive heart failure. An estimated 4.6 million Americans have congestive heart failure, and 43,000 die from it every year. Strokes are also associated with tobacco use, and tobacco is a major cause of strokes. The U.S. incident of strokes is estimated at 700,000 cases per year, and Oregon has a very high incident of stroke in this state. It's higher per capita than across the country. As Brett already talked about, smokeless tobacco causes oral cancer, tooth decay, gum disease, and increases the risk of heart disease, as I've already talked about. We're particularly concerned about this product, obviously, because its appeal to youth. And one of the documents that I sent around is from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, which is a leading organization that specifically focuses on the marketing and youth and trying to prevent tobacco use by youth. Some of these statistics are from there. They recently released a report that shows that there's been a 36% increase in smokeless tobacco use by high school boys since 2003. And both boys and men are using both cigarettes and smokeless products. More than a third of men over 25 who used smokeless tobacco on some days also smoked cigarettes every day, according to a 2010 study. And high school boys who used smokeless tobacco were 5 times more likely to smoke half a pack of cigarettes a day compared with boys who didn't use smokeless products. Clearly, as you can see from the picture, it's very appealing to youth and from the products that went around. Very colorfully packaged, resembles mints, gums. I actually purchased the gum and the Marlboro Snooze and was grabbing stuff out of my purse this morning, wanting to grab some gum and grab the Marlboro instead. And just clearly, you know, you have them both in your purse. They look, you know, identical, essentially, and it's hard to see one from the other. Similar story, actually. I'm married to a previous smoker. It's good to know we have strong wives and strong women. Smoked for about 10 years before we met. He has not smoked for 10 years since. And brought those products into my home last night. And he said to me that, you know, get those products out of the house now, because even seeing them and having them around is, you know, was making him think about smoking again, and it's incredible to see the addictive nature of these products, even though he has not smoked a cigarette in 10 years, and said, you know, get those out of our house, and obviously concerned for our son as well, who's 2, and seeing them and playing with them, and how similarly they look, and obviously the dangers associated with that. So I just want to also call to your attention the increased marketing specifically around young boys, but young men and women for smokeless products. We're increasingly seeing expansive marketing in more magazines, in newspapers, in youth outlets and media outlets, and increasingly concerned and moving away from kind of the fishing and stream and more of the men's magazines to much more youth marketing products. And also just to call your attention that, you know, this is a deadly habit, it's addictive, and it's also costly. So Oregon spends more than $1 billion in direct medical costs associated with tobacco-related issues. That covers payers, both public and private, and according to the CDC, $340 million of that is in direct Medicaid costs to the Oregon Health Plan. So we're paying for this with our public dollars as well. So we thank you for holding this hearing, and we strongly urge your support of banning these products in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions from either of these testifiers? Thank you both very much. With that, we will call Thad Marty and Mark Nelson.
Excuse me, this is my first time, so I'm a little bit nervous.
Well, welcome. Thank you for coming to your
thank
capital.
You. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. My name's Thad Marney. First, I'd like to explain briefly why I'm here and who I am and why I'm here. I'm one of the founding board members of an organization called the Consumer Advocates for Smoke-Free Alternatives Association. We're a nonprofit organization that works to ensure the availability of reduced harm alternatives to smoking and to provide the public with truthful information about such alternatives. For the record, I'm an unpaid representative. I have no vested interest in tobacco, pharmaceutical, or any other company. I was raised, a little bit about my background, I was raised in a Christian home, taught to never ever smoke, had my first cigarette when I was 18, and a friend asked me to hold her cigarettes, said she was going to quit, and then she asked for them back a few days later. I got upset, said, if you take these back, I'm going to smoke one, and you'll be sick, and it'll be on you. Smoked my first cigarette, and a few times after that, I smoked socially. It wasn't until, actually, I was closer to 21 when I got my first job in tech support that I started smoking. My smoking turned from just a social thing into a more expensive habit that I was doing all the time. And as soon as I realized that I was addicted, I wanted to stop. First tried quitting using cold turkey. Then I tried quitting using the patch. Then I tried quitting using the gum. Then I tried quitting using the lozenge. Then I tried quitting using hypnotherapy. Went back through them. Each time, I'd stay quit for a little while, but eventually life stress would get back, and I would find myself smoking again. That is until it wasn't actually these products. I found the electronic cigarette sitting in the mall one day. I thought it was interesting. Being a tech nerd myself, I thought the gadget was fascinating. I bought one, spent too much money buying it in the mall. And within a few days, a few of the parts had gotten lost, so it didn't really get used much for about the first year or so. But then in about September, October of 2009, my daughter, who was 7 at the time, saw me going out for a cigarette and said, "Daddy, isn't that pretend cigarette supposed to be better for you? You should use that instead." And that got me thinking. I got online, looked into information about the e-cigarettes, and found a better model, one that was a lot cheaper, more affordable. It ended up being cheaper than smoking. Found flavors and nicotine strengths that worked for me, specific to my addiction. Eventually found something that I liked as well, if not better, than smoking. And without even trying, I never actually decided to quit smoking. I just found something I liked better. And in fact, when I realized that I had stopped smoking altogether, I decided, just to have a date to point to, that I would smoke one more cigarette on New Year's Eve 2009, and that was the last cigarette I've smoked. And I did it intentionally just because to prove I could do it. I could honestly smoke another cigarette right now and wouldn't like it. But that's not why I'm here. The reason I'm here is I found out that that's what worked for me. Not everyone, not every smoker is the same. Some people, just having the hand-to-mouth is all they need. Just having the nicotine. Some people, for about 2% of the population, nicotine replacement therapy works, but it doesn't work for everyone. And if we're honestly interested in reducing smoking for as many people as possible, we need to have as many alternatives available for as many people as possible. That's why we created the organization I represent, CASA. I'm actually an Oregonian myself, so this is important to me here. I personally tried the products that they were passing out here, and wasn't really for me. I did like the Camel strips because sometimes using just the e-cigarette, you only get the nicotine. You don't get the other chemicals that are in tobacco, and so sometimes there's a little bit of a feeling of something missing. And for the people that e-cigarettes don't work for, a lot of times products like these tobacco products you're passing around are just the thing for those particular people. And for me, it was nice to have a pack. One pack lasted me about a year. I've still got a few of the strips left in a coat somewhere that I use if I get a craving still for a cigarette and don't want to smoke. The majority, Representative Canada mentioned, talked about the poisonings. The majority of nicotine poisonings actually happen from the pharmaceutical patch. It continues to deliver nicotine even after you've gotten enough, and so some people will continue smoking, or it'll just keep giving them nicotine if they want it or not. And so that's actually the most common way to overdose from nicotine, is from the patch. Second most common way that poisonings happen is from tobacco cigarettes. Small babies finding cigarette butts in ashtrays, chewing them. That 10 to 1, those outnumber poisonings from smokeless tobacco, is children eating combustible cigarettes. Neither of those are in this ban. So banning these products won't do anything about the largest causes of nicotine poisonings. I noticed they brought the pictures and brought in the candy orbs that look brown and really don't look particularly like candy. They look like little brown pellets. What looks a lot more like candy or breath mints, I would say, would be the pharmaceutical Nicorette lozenges that come in a very easy to open package, they just cost more. So for all those reasons, we're encouraging you to vote no on 3588. It creates penalties for the sale of alternative tobacco products to adult consumers in Oregon. Research shows that over 99% of the diseases and deaths associated with tobacco use are caused by smoking the tobacco. The most hazardous levels of carcinogens and toxins are carried in the smoke itself. Because smokeless tobacco products do not expose the user to smoke, experts believe they carry little to no significant health risks. Smokers who cannot or will not quit using tobacco should be encouraged to switch to a smokeless alternative, which would greatly decrease their health risks. To encourage adult smokers to use reduced-risk tobacco products, the products should be made as accessible and affordable as cigarettes. This bill would leave the most hazardous tobacco products, cigarettes, available in most retail outlets while severely restricting the availability of reduced-risk products. Claims that smokeless tobacco products are marketed to attract children using candy flavors are irrational. Adult nicotine products such as Nicorette gum and lozenges are readily available in such flavors as Fruit Chill, Cinnamon Surge, Fresh Mint, Cappuccino, Cherry, and Orange. It is obvious that these flavors are expected to and do appeal to adult smokers and are not targeting children. If the products are unpalatable, smokers will have little incentive to switch. Smokeless, dissolvable tobacco products should be sold and displayed in the same manner as any other tobacco or nicotine product. Sale to minors should be prohibited, and products should be kept out of reach of children. In preparing for today's meeting, a friend of ours, Bill Godshall, who's the president of Smoke Free Pennsylvania, gave me a list of points specifically to target on this issue, and I want to go through those real quickly. Number one, non-combustible tobacco products, as I've mentioned, are 99% less hazardous than cigarettes. Basically, you remove the fire, you remove most of the harm from smoking. You've taken out smoking. Two, switching to smokeless tobacco reduces a smoker's health risks nearly as much as quitting all tobacco or nicotine altogether. And I'll point out that if for the lucky person who manages to quit smoking using the pharmaceutical aids like I tried, I wasn't alone in having tried. The majority of people who've switched to reduced harm alternatives have tried upwards of 10 or more times to quit smoking. The success rates of pharmaceutical NRTs start at a measly 7%. And drop to only 2% of people who quit smoking after using an NRT are still smoking within 20 months after ending therapy. The addiction to nicotine is long-lasting, and it's bad. I'm not trying to justify the addiction of nicotine, but addiction isn't nearly as bad as cancer, and smoking causes cancer. Nicotine does not. Third point, several million smokers in the U.S. have already quit smoking by switching to smokeless tobacco products. Four, many or most flavored smokeless tobacco products are marketed to adult smokers as alternatives to cigarettes. No evidence has been presented indicating that tobacco products are being targeted marketed to youth. And I know you might have some questions, but I'll point out that the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement prohibits manufacturers from target marketing tobacco products to youth, so any violations should be reported to the State Attorney General for remedial adjudication. I think that's a really important point that needs to be brought up. If you actually have any true concerns about these products being marketed towards children, that needs to go through the Attorney General's office. That really is not a policy decision. Number seven, Oregon, as well as other states, already prohibit tobacco sales to minors under 18. So any violations of that, if children are getting hold of it, that also goes through the state or local health departments for enforcement. We actually do a pretty good job here in Oregon, I think, of enforcing the underage smoking ban. Granted, some still get through, but I think the best way to prevent that is to actually have the laws prohibiting sales again for minors. If you outlaw it for adults, you're not really doing anything to keep it out of children's hands. Virtually all retailers that allow youth in stores keep tobacco products behind the counter or in locked storage containers requiring retailer clerk assistance, no self-service. Actually, I believe that is already the law in Oregon, that tobacco products have to be kept behind the counter. So as long as we consider it a tobacco product, it's already covered. Number nine, tobacco products should never be called candy. It's a bit offensive that we do in this bill. And the only people who have been calling them candy are those who oppose adult smokers reducing their health risks by switching to these far less hazardous smokeless products. Ten, there is no evidence that flavorings encourage youth to begin using tobacco, as Marlboro Red and Marlboro Gold cigarettes, neither of which are flavored, are the tobacco brands used most often by youth. I want to thank you very much for your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. You did an eloquent job on indicating the addictive nature of tobacco and how difficult it is to get off that addiction. Thank you so much. Any questions of this?
Yeah,
yes, Representative Green.
Is your organization funded by tobacco company?
No, we're not. We are entirely funded. I'm here voluntarily. We're here. We get donations from other people who mostly have switched to using the e-cigarettes. But like I mentioned before, some people rely on snus or a combination of snus or dissolvables and e-cigarettes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the testimony. I'm familiar with both the, not personally, but familiar with the addictive qualities of nicotine and of the other health hazards of smoking. I was unaware until now, based on what you say, of the separation of nicotine and other health risks, coronary vessel cancer, etc. Is this extremely well documented and accepted?
Well,
to you and anyone else in the room who knows
the documentation that I would point to would be the documentation that was used to certify the pharmaceutical nicotine products. There have not been any adverse health effects reported from long-term use of the Nicorette gum, the patch, and that sort of thing. There's short-term things that can happen, endothelial dysfunction, but that can happen from anything. Basically,
oral cancer from chewing tobacco.
Oral cancer. That's a great question.
Finally, got one.
The CDC's own numbers estimated. You probably heard the 400,000 annual deaths of smokers from smoking. That's a combination of all the possible methods of deaths. Lung cancer, heart cancer, throat cancer, all the different things lumped together on an annual basis. They estimate about 400,000 are caused each year by smoking. Using those same, that's based on 46 million American smokers. If there were 46 million smokeless tobacco users, keeping in mind that when they refer to smokeless tobacco, they're referring to the old style Skoal and, chewing tobacco and dry snuff that is high in tobacco specific nitrosamines, which are carcinogenic. Would result in an additional 6,000 deaths annually from oral cancer, which is actually less than the 12,000 or 13,000 deaths from oral cancer from smoking. There is a risk of oral cancer from smokeless tobacco, the older products, but it's less than the risk of oral cancer from smoking. And newer products, like the ones we have here, the dissolvables and the Swedish-style snus, where they came from, it was originally in Sweden, they didn't have access to high-quality tobacco, so they came up with a process of pasteurizing the tobacco leaves to make them more palatable. They added a little bit of salt and sweetener so that it would go in your mouth and doesn't require spitting, it doesn't hurt you if you swallow, and had the unintended side effect of eliminating the majority of the tobacco-specific nitrosamines, making it so that these new products, including the ones that you're trying to ban in this bill, have not been linked to any increases in cancer. The increased statistics that have been stated related to smokeless tobacco are specific to the older forms of smokeless tobacco that do not have the reduced levels of nitrosamines or are specific to smoking. Most of them are actually specific issues to smoking. When you light tobacco on fire, it gets a lot more dangerous.
Representative Harker, we have Dr. Cohen here who can answer some of these questions with this testimony.
Great.
If that's okay with you.
Perfect.
Sorry.
All right. Thank you very much. Mark, thank you for waiting.
Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam and members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent R.J. Reynolds Tobacco as well as 7-Eleven stores here in Oregon. I'm learning some things today from this witness. We, as you would expect, oppose House Bill 3588. It calls for a ban on all flavored moist smokeless tobacco, as well as products that RJR puts out, known as dissolvable tobacco products. Keep in mind that traditional tobacco flavors such as menthol, wintergreen, and mint have been available in the marketplace for over 100 years. And these products are marketed as menthol, which are picked up by the wording in this bill. As such, we believe the proposal goes too far in removing tobacco products, because it would effectively ban about 60% of all the moist MST products sold in the state of Oregon. And that's a very large number, and I'm sure that is part of its purpose. Obviously, we disagree with that purpose. By our estimate, it would decrease state revenue probably by about $22 million based upon market share of this type of product in the state, assuming that those same adult consumers will go someplace else on the black market or some other sources outside of Oregon to continue to buy that product. Again, we believe that we've had discussions in this committee and other committees as well that there is a huge black market out there in terms of tobacco products. Even the Department of Revenue estimated about 8 years ago that the state of Oregon is losing about $100 million a year to non-taxed sales of tobacco products. As, of course, the tax goes up, whether it's more in Oregon than Washington, or more in Washington than Oregon as it is today, you, of course, increase cross-border sales to a tremendous degree, and that is happening now, actually, in Oregon's favor, in that you have huge amounts of Washingtonians coming over and buying the tobacco products in this state. So, in terms of these products, if you ban these products, again, it's about 60% of the market for these products in the state that we estimate will be banned. You will just move people to that black market, cross-border sales, Indian reservations, what we call gray market, black market, as well as internet sales. And in the end, back to our 7-Eleven client, the people who really get hurt, of course, are the Oregon's retail and commercial wholesale community, who are impacted by the 60% drop in those sales, and that, of course, hurts their business, their profits, and, of course, causes job losses. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mark. Any questions of Mr. Nelson? Thank you both for coming to testify today.
Down there, Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Oh.
I am curious about where these products are being marketed. In particular, certain communities have health issues already that are related to tobacco use, both smoked and unsmoked tobacco use, and in other areas as well, regarding alcohol consumption and others. There are certain communities that are noted for being what are called fresh food deserts, which have a great number of places like 7-Elevens and small stores like that. Were these being marketed in particular areas, or test marketed in particular areas of the country? And if so, where and why?
Madam Co-Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Frederick, in the handout we handed to you about dissolvables, which. I'm not speaking to smokeless tobacco products at this time, and this has been an issue here in Oregon as well as currently in other states. Is they chose about 3 or 4 years ago to market R.J. Reynolds to market dissolvables in two cities. One was Portland, and I believe the other one was in either Texas or Arizona, but I don't recall. Currently, we've continued that marketing in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Denver, Colorado. As to why those particular cities, I don't know from a marketing point of view. Typically, they look at the demographics of the city and make a determination as to why and to which ones represent a cross-section of what they think represents the country. I'm not privy to those, that how that decision is made.
Follow up, if you don't mind. I would be curious to find out more about the demographics and the suggestions there, especially as it relates to the youth community in those particular areas, because it, despite your suggestion that those brownlings look like little pellets, they look like candy to me. And they look like candy to most of the most children that I've seen regarding this, and it is a significant concern because addiction. You're correct. Smoking has a particular effect, but nicotine addiction is a significant problem as well. And I am in no way wanting to see more of that addiction take place for any kids. So as you look at that, just keep in mind that those are my concerns. Thank you.
Representative Harper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading through the bill quickly. Fortunately, it's short, so I've actually read through it a couple of times here. It requires, what we're addressing here is, and is dissolvable, right? This is one of the qualifications of what this does. Am I missing something there? I think that limits where the scope of this the proposed ban.
Right. That means it doesn't. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. That means it does not ban the pharmaceutical products that also look like candy, because they're not dissolvable. Well, actually, they are dissolvable. So I'm not sure. Maybe they would qualify.
Co-Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam and Representative Harker, our analysis of the bill is that it extends to moist, smokeless tobacco products that are flavored, because they are flavored, and our particular ones are menthol, wintergreen, and mint. They are designed to, they can dissolve in the mouth, and it's usually spit out, as you know. People can say it looks like candy, or can accuse the company of marketing it like candy. Our analysis by our attorneys is that the bill goes beyond dissolvables.
And we can clarify that later.
Okay, let's get that clarified then.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's not the way I see it, but
okay.
Be happy to have an interpretation that it doesn't.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you both very much. Dr. Cohn, thank you for staying. And I think Representative Harper had a couple of questions that you could answer.
Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Harker, for the record, Dr. Mel Cohn, Public Health Director and State Public Health Officer. So I just wanted to speak a little bit to the science on this about disease causing.
Please.
It's definitely true that cigarette smoke contains a long list of contaminants, many of which are very, very hazardous to health. And it's also true that chew tobacco contains a lot of chemicals and additives that are very hazardous to health, oral cancer being, you know, the one that we worry the most about. The data about the number of people who have who are estimated to die, for example, from these various kinds of cancers, it's a little bit unfair to imply that because fewer people die from oral cancer, that means that these products are less hazardous. Fewer people are using them because most people who use tobacco products smoke. That definitely is true. And with respect to the dissolvable products and their health risks, I think the jury is still out on that. Nicotine does carry some health risks, certainly for small children who ingest too much. It's a very serious, it can be, in fact, life-threatening for them. For adults used in, you know, the right amount, the health risks are probably less than cigarette smoke or chew tobacco, but many of the cardiovascular effects, the effects on the blood vessels in the body, still occur because of the nicotine specifically. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Tell us about tobacco use among teenagers. High school kids, didn't I read some statistic recently that's picking up again?
Chair Tomei, yes. We are concerned that we haven't been able to make as much of a dent in tobacco use among kids as we might like to. We know that people who start using tobacco products, the earlier people start using them, the more difficult it is to break that addiction further down the road. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but you are right. We are starting to see a pickup among youth, and it's very, very concerning to us.
Thank you. Any further questions? You look, Representative Harker, like you're thinking about something.
I am. I apologize. I'm scratching my brain. I'm trying to get in the Wayback Machine to remember everything I can about nicotinic and muscarinic receptors, and I'll just leave it for now. Okay. We'll come back.
All right. Any further questions of Dr. Cannon? Okay. Representative Cannon?
Just very briefly. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to say two things about the bill. One, the definition was drafted narrowly. That was our intention. It was, I'm sure there are many who would support a broader definition, but we were attempting to get at products that resemble candy, okay? Not tobacco cessation products, not products that are marketed as tobacco cessation products, but products that dissolve in your mouth and, as
and
Representative
not
Harker, not or, but as Representative Harker correctly noted, and are marketed or resemble candy. So I think that's one very important point. And then speaking to the science and the health risks here, I'll read just one sentence from Pediatrics, this study. Ingestion of as little as 1 milligram of nicotine by a small child can produce symptoms such as nausea and vomiting. The camel orbs that were on the screen and passed around contained approximately 1 milligram of nicotine. So one orb in a small child, potentially nausea and vomiting. Many orbs in a small child, much more severe symptoms, including possible respiratory arrest and death. That's what we're talking about here. I look forward to returning to the conversation.
Thank you very much, both of you. Anything further? All right. Thank you very much, everybody who came to testify on this. Appreciate the information. And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 3588. Okay, we're going to stand at ease for a few minutes. you ready? I'll reopen the Human Services Committee and on the work session on House Bill 2235. Colleagues, we're looking at the Dash 5 amendment. And Ms. Bradley, could you come up and talk with us about the Dash 5? And we're looking to rescind the referral, thank you, to Ways and Means. And she's going to explain to us how the Dash 5 allows us to do that.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Oregon Health Division. The Dash 5 speaks to a couple of specific points that we just want to point out to the committee. Number one, incorporating in the amendments, we did remove the requirement for essentially rolling out a statewide teaching education program for providers that we were looking at probably doing a subcontract on. We do not have funding for that, and so that's been removed. What we left in place could be accommodating within existing resources within the department in terms of working on information materials and posting it. We also had the language changed for the Hospital Association and the Medical Association that they were supportive of, so that it is no longer that they shall do education and training, but they may, and we have commitments from both organizations to work with us and to continue to move that forward. And then the intent is, if there are opportunities, we will certainly be looking for funding, because we do want to look at doing some more expanded education and training, and if we're able to secure funding, we could move in that direction, but the language does not obligate the department to do it without funding.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Bradley? Yes, Representative Thompson.
Why do we need this bill if there's no funding? And you can, why can't you just do it?
Representative Tomei and Gilliam, thank you, and Representative Thompson. The implications are significant, I think, in terms of asking that there actually be a maternal depression program that is established within the Office of Family Health, that we will continue to do work that comes from the recommendations from the work group. There also are expectations of participation and involvement with the Hospital Association and the Medical Association.
Further questions? And we did get from the co-speakers permission to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
And thank you for coming up and putting on the record what we discussed. prior, this is, again, we're down to the wire on these things. So prior to the discussion that we had about these Dash 5s, my preference was to send this to Ways and Means. Given this explanation, given I'm sure everybody's commitment to the larger policy issue, it's my intention to move the Dash 5s. And I believe that our co-speakers' offices and our, again, our co-conspirators down in Freeman and Kotek, down in Ways and Means, also are okay with this. So these are kind of last-minute changes, but I wanted the committee to know that I'm comfortable with it, and I appreciate your work on this, and we shall try to move the Dash 5s.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move we adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2235, dated 4/19/11.
Representative, or Chair Gilliam, moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments, dated 4/19/11. Any discussion? Any objection? So adopted.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill 2235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Aye.
Representative
Hartman. Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Wyman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Chair Gomez.
Aye. Having received the required majority, this motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the floor. Oh, I will carry it. Thank you, Representative. Okay, with that, thank you so much for all the work I know that you two have done through the years. Thank you so much, and we're pleased to have this. Colleague, before we close the meeting, I know you're going to be so disappointed to hear this, but we will not be meeting until 9 o'clock on Monday morning. And I'm sorry, I don't want to hear any discussion. No argument.
Can we vote on that?
No.
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock on Monday.
The only just thing that is coming Monday, or is this ongoing?
Just this coming Monday, and we will see how much work we have to do. We will be wanting to make some trips, field trips. We want to go to the new state hospital, and that's something I would like to, do we have time? We have a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to talk about what other ideas you might have. We obviously want to hear more from TANF. We will make sure that that happens. We will have time now to have informational hearings. We'll have time to make field trips. Another field trip that has been suggested, the Department of Corrections would like us to visit their mental health facilities at the Department of Corrections here in Salem. So if you've got any ideas now, or if you have any ideas you want to propose for later.
There's some really good programs in Hawaii.
Is that right?
All right, sign on.
I think there's a lobbyist we can contact about.
Yeah, that's right. They'll fight it. Sure there is.
In the wrong term, Representative.
He's probably going to hit me when I leave here, hopefully.
Any other? So come up with some ideas. So we will be meeting at 9 on this coming Monday. We'll see about future meetings. But 9 o'clock on Monday, we'll send an email reminding you of that. Anything else, Mr. Co-Chair?
There's no truth to the rumor that we're having a public hearing on buzzless tequila. Just wanted to know that.
Better.
Yeah, right. Okay, with that, I close the House Committee on Human Services.